All lines are now bridged.
All right.
Okay, thank you. Good afternoon, everybody. I'm Mike Berry. I'm with ONC, and I'm happy to kick off our meeting number two of the Interoperability Standards Priorities Task Force. I'm going to start with roll call, and then we'll get started. I'll start with our co-chairs, Ari and Malik.
Good morning and or afternoon.
David McCauley.
Likewise, good afternoon.
Ricky Bloomfield. I see Ricky on, but he might be muted. Cynthia Fisher. Valerie Gray. Jim Jurgis. Edward June. Ken Kawamoto.
Hello.
Victor Lee. Les Leonard. Clem McDonald. Jack Poe.
Yeah.
Raj Watwani. Ram Sharam.
Present.
Sasha Termott. Andy Truscott.
Good afternoon.
And then Scott Weingarten. Okay, if I didn't hear your name, we'll keep an eye out for you, and I'll take note as the call goes on. Thank you all, and I'll turn it over to Arian and David.
Great. So Ricky says he's here but not on audio yet. And hopefully Ricky will not repeat his timing of where we called on him and then he left just in time not to get called on. So we'll make sure to call in Ricky early. We've got a pretty packed agenda today. So we collected a bunch of input in last call. Our goal was to go broad and then start putting together a prioritization recommendation framework so that we can start to narrow and go deep. So David's going to walk us through the going broad framework, and then I'll walk us through the proposed prioritization framework and proposed recommendations framework, and we'll get feedback on both of those. There's a lot of information on the go broad section, so the request when David walks through that is let's just make sure we got completeness and not dive into any of the topics at this point. Let's just make sure that we've got the territory and the map covered before we start drawing in all the blue squiggly lines. And then let's make sure we reserve some time to think about the prioritization framework and the recommendation framework, again, from the point of view of thinking about how we narrow down the very large list that we have down to a smaller and manageable list that allows ONC to get the kinds of recommendations that are useful to advance the national agenda. So if we go to the next slide. And the next one. So again, our goal is priority uses, identifying existing standards and implementation specifications, make appropriate recommendations. As usual, that's the inside the coloring lines. We as a federal advisory committee, you know, we get tasked, but there's sometimes we draw outside of the coloring lines. And in particular, I think what we saw for orders and results was that in many cases, when we did a deep dive of the standards, there were some cases where, you know, we had all the standards in place, but we weren't using them. And in other cases, we didn't have the standards and needed to keep evolving them. So in the cases where the standards and keep using them, you know, oftentimes we've got policy alignment issues. And I think it's useful to point out those areas where good news, we've got all the standards, but we may have some policy and ecosystem alignment uses. But our must-have for this task force is to identify priority uses for existing standard specification and recommendations for future ones. All right. Next slide. And over to David.
Thanks. Thanks, Arian. Before we dive into this overwhelming list of topics, I just want to add one comment on the tail end of what Arian just said about the notion of making recommendations. We are on, in this list, you'll see as we dive into it, we cover areas that are not strictly limited to ONC's purview, but include CDC, FDA, and CMS, and possibly other agencies. And Erin and I both got feedback that recommendations that are broader than just ONC's mandate are valued by ONC because they participate in these interagency meetings frequently. And hearing from an ONC FACA that something is important is useful, even if it's strictly speaking broader than ONC. So I don't think we should shy away from thinking about some of these areas that are maybe a little bit broader than the strict ONC purview. Arian, is that you agree with that?
Yeah, completely agree. Although, as usual, all of our recommendations need to be formulated in the master phrase, we recommend that ONC coordinate, as opposed to, you know, we recommend that FDA do X, Y, and Z. But because
right.
ONC is the national coordinator, then that coordination role is vital and essential, and it's useful for example, FDA to know that standards alignment between FDA and clinical interoperability is a good thing, just to pick a random example.
Great. Thanks for that reminder. Okay, so what I did here on this slide, what Arian and I did is go through our notes from the first meeting and a couple of outside conversations and follow-up to that first meeting where people clarified their thoughts and try to put a top-down view of the domains that surfaced, that came up in the meeting. So I tried to get everything that was mentioned enough to attract the group's attention. There's a couple of things that just got in passing mentioned that we decided to drop, although you guys should feel free to bring them back up in the later part of our session today where we solicit for additional ideas. So let me just walk through these to tell you what I mean by the titles here. And then each one of these has a slide coming up that goes into more of the bullet points that we actually discussed. And as Arian suggested at the beginning, the goal of this call is not to refine these, but to make sure we didn't miss something completely or misinterpret or misunderstand. So these categories are somewhat arbitrary. Maybe they overlap a little bit, the nature of what we do. First, improving syndromic surveillance, the ability for early detection of emerging problems in public health or in routine healthcare. That was number one. Number two, improving situational awareness for public health emergencies. Situational awareness is targeted more at the actual mechanisms for delivering public health, such as status of ventilators and beds and facilities. Number three, address gaps in vaccination reporting data flow. We had quite an extensive conversation on what parts of that current data flow work and which parts don't work. Number four is a broad topic we've rolled up into just the notion of health equity issues that can be both access issues and failure to capture critical information to help us understand health equity gaps and so forth. Number five, better usage of EHR data for public health and other purposes. Broad theme there is we are now capturing a tremendous amount of digital data. Not all of it is being put to good use yet for things like public health. Number six, gaps in adverse event reporting. This was mentioned. We didn't put a lot of time into it, but it came up that some of the adverse event tracking is not computable and perhaps is fragmented in ways that we could spend some time thinking about improving. Number seven, contact and exposure tracking. Can we manage pandemics better if we improve systems that enable contact and exposure tracking? Number eight is a bit of a holdover from an unfinished part of our 2019 agenda, care plans and chronic disease burden. We didn't talk much about it in our last call, but we did highlight that it was sort of unfinished business from the previous incarnation of our task force. Number nine, better and easier binding between persons and their digital devices. We didn't go deep on this one, but it got mentioned. Number 10, better integration of clinical and administrative data. It's a a broad domain where there's a recognition that some of the emerging APIs, in particular derivative of and implementation guides around FHIR, have had splits between clinical workflows and administrative workflows. And we put this on the list to see if we want to think about maybe including doing better integration between those two. Number 11 was suggested to us from the outside, but a topic that has become come up a number of times is improving the data sharing across VA, DOD, and non-governmental systems, in particular security issues that make APIs flowing across those boundaries problematic. And then last, number 12, vaccination passports. I put this in parentheses and put it last because ONC has clarified for us that they already have active work in that space and requested that we not put additional effort into that space. So it came up in our conversation last week, but we're going to take it off of our table since it's already being aggressively worked by ONC. So let me stop there.
There is a very severe echo.
If you do not have your phone on mute, please put your phone on mute unless you're not talking.
Yeah, or it may be that you got your speakers turned on. Well, whatever. Okay, so while whoever was trying to say something figures that out, Aaron, do you have anything to add to this overview?
Nope. Just would request people, if they can, raise their hands before they tag in. And David, I'll help you watch hands and run interference for you.
Okay. Is everybody comfortable that what we're doing? We're going to just go through these one by one and maybe get one level deeper than the high level summary I gave. Let's just get started, and if it doesn't work, we'll fix it. So next slide, please. So on the topic of syndromic surveillance, there was a general notion that there are still too much siloing of data, in particular lab data, that's getting abandoned from a public health awareness point of view. In particular, bullet point number two, there are, we also considered, we had discussions to address gaps in the roll-up of data to state and local aggregators. There's still some excessive variability in lab messages, despite a lot of work to try to homogenize in that space. Early detection and reporting of novel variants was mentioned. We didn't go deep on it. Electronic case reporting was brought up just in passing, that we should maybe spend a few minutes thinking about whether that's working as well as it could, and then revisit CMS's decision to drop quality measures for lab reporting, which has essentially created it took away an incentive that was helping address some of the siloing of data. Those were the topics that we got in our notes for syndromic surveillance. Anybody have things to add or critique? When we're going to go in our later sessions, we'll put some of this online in a spreadsheet and allow for a lot more fleshing out of details. So if you've got a hot burning detail, save it, and we'll have plenty of time to address it later. But if there's a high level thing, raise your hand and we'll go. But not seeing anything on that one, let's move to the next slide.
Clem and Rom have their hands up.
Okay, great. Clem, I'll go first with you since Arian said your name first.
Clem, can you see?
Are you talking to Clem?
Talking to Clem,
yeah.
Oh, yeah. Regarding the, I think the original process, they focused an awful lot on x-rays. And they were planning on doing text reporting. I think we all investigate a little bit more about what they really did with them and whether they ran into troubles with the surveillance sort of studies. They were looking for pneumonias.
Uh-huh. But there are some syndrome.
Yeah,
there
most are of the surveillance, just to be really clear, most of the surveillance that's done at this level is reportable condition surveillance. So that's the CDA templates where hospitals send out reportable conditions and then ADT notifications. So most of the ILI syndromic surveillance gets done via ADT. One of the things that we discovered when we looked at the work here was that we had good ADT coverage, but it was some states were sort of off the grid. And then we were missing cases of hospitalization because the ADT feeds only looked at ED-based use cases. But we were missing ambulatory ILI and then also missing hospitalized ILI. Once we had the ILI feeds for through the ADT, adding additional filters for COVID-like symptoms was relatively simple. So I think, Clem, what you're suggesting is in addition to the ADT and reportable conditions, CDA-based syndromic surveillance, we might consider adding radiological findings-based syndromic surveillance.
Well, I wasn't actually suggesting what to add. My understanding is that's what they asked for in the beginning. And also there's a message specified in HDL7B2 for lab tests and I think something about radiology stuff. The initial stimulus is anthrax and bioterrorism and some kind of pulmonary phenomenon. And of course, they could find that the lab test, but I don't know what they actually did, or whether they dropped that, whether they're seriously using it, and how they use it. So I think it'd be helpful to understand what went on from the beginning until now. The ADT is clearly a good one, but that wasn't what they started with, I didn't think.
Gotcha. All I'm reporting, Clem, is what's in the meaningful use or what's in the ONC certification criteria. So we have certification criteria for ADT-based syndromic surveillance, reportable conditions via CDA, and then ELR as the main certification.
So the ELR was a HL7B2 one. That
yep, that's right. Okay, cool. Ron?
Okay, good point.
Yeah, this is Ram here. I have a question about, when you're talking about data transfer and things like that and protocols, what about the test procedures for those? How do you test it's actually being done the way that it should be done?
Are you referring to testing of the actual interfaces?
That needs to be taken into
account. I don't think there is a robust mechanism for many of these where it's up to the sending system to decide that it's got a reportable incident. We don't know how.
For the ones that are only certification criteria, their associated test criteria, whether they work or not is a different question.
Yeah, there's obviously success of the API itself, the technical test, and then there's the does it work in the workflow of the real world test.
So Mike, that's a good somebody point else from the ONC team, can you confirm, because as I think about it, I'm not sure that the ADT event notification is a certified health IT criterion, even though it is fairly broadly adopted through CDC. So that might be an area where there's a gap. Maybe if we can do some investigation there and report back, that would be useful. And then,
thank you.
David, you have ECR as a question mark. Let me just give you a little backgrounder on ECR. So ECR is a CDC standard, a CDC interoperability initiative that is electronic case retrieval. And so the goal is to create a trigger-based mechanism to report out cases of interest, started with some of the early work that was done on Zika, putting in place a Smart on Fire decision support hooks app in to collect additional information on Zika. And there's now two flavors of this, ECR, which is a CDA-based reporting mechanism. It is adopted by a number of Epic hospitals, as well as a number of Cerner-based hospitals, and I think is somewhere in the deployment cycle nationally for both Epic and Cerner, and do not know where it is for the other EHRs. And then there's ECR Now, which is a DC, Disney Sports Hooks Smart on Fire app that does much the same thing, pulls information and reports back to CDC. And the goal was to replace the paper-based case reports that were being done for COVID, and health systems that were connected to ECR reported that they were actually getting the ECR case reports before they were getting ELR information. So they were able to fast track investigations in areas where they were get the case reports. But I just want to provide a backgrounder for why that one's on the list.
Okay, let's go on. We've got a lot to cover. And again, we'll have time when we identify our priority items to go much deeper than we're going right now. So let's go to the next slide. I should have numbered these, but I'm sorry. This is number two, improving situational awareness for public health emergencies. So the core thought that has bounced around in some of the discussions here is probably going to turn out to be looking at the emerging profile of fire called SANER. It's down there next to the last bullet point, which proposes to address some of the reporting variations that are currently accomplished in non-computable ways and with lots of variation, and turn it into something that can be made more computable and on demand. I'll just, maybe jump ahead of the game and say there's a notion that we should probably, if we choose to prioritize on this area, probably get someone to come and walk us through what SANER is trying to do. Some of the related activities that we got, the related concepts that we discussed briefly in our first call was whether or not there was a role for TEFCA as it emerges to address some of the access to this data. And then there was a lot of talk about the problem of non-computable and state-by-state variation that makes this a challenging problem for systems to deal with. So I would say this is the SANER topic, if you want. Whether or not SANER is something we decide to push on, we have to decide coming fall in the future meetings. Arian, you have comments, broader ones, and then
nope.
See if their hands. Any comments on this one from the team? Pretty straightforward. Okay, let's go to the next slide. Number three, address gaps in vaccine reporting data flow. I guess I wasn't thinking about it when I put that title up. There's a flow of the vaccines and the flow of the vaccinations, and they really are different. I know, Arian, you have been spending a fair amount of time analyzing the flow of the actual supply chain in California. So this slide's probably not accurately titled. But I think in the meeting,
I think vaccination reporting, which is really the vaccine supply chain piece of this, I think is sort of out of scope for health IT, but definitely vaccination reporting reconciliation is in scope.
And what we heard in the discussion, I think Les Leonard was one of the drivers of this part of the discussion, that some of the data flows inbound from EHR and established vaccination administration systems into local public health is well supported with standards and actually works pretty well in many settings. But getting the data out of the public health facility, particularly in group level access to the data like county-wide statistics, was lacking. Didn't exist in some ways. And then there was a secondary concern that as we ramp up things like mass immunization events, wondering whether those events are generating the flow of data to local public health officials or not. And I put out some queries to my colleagues at Cerner, for example, and they said that they know in some of the settings the data does flow, but they weren't sure about all of the settings. Like when we're having a big one in Kansas City at Arrowhead Stadium with 6,000 people or so will get vaccinated. Is that data going to flow to the right places? Is an open question. So any comments on this one? Hands, let's see. Clem, go ahead.
Just before Clem jumps in, data flow inbound is state dependent. So it really depends on where we are. Sorry, Clem, go ahead.
I don't think the flow is the problem. I think the problem is there's no strict identification about who the person is who got it. So if they're going to be using this for a passport or really to be sure what's going on, we've got to get that fixed. I mean, I got my shot. They asked me if I had insurance, but they didn't ask the insurance company. They didn't ask my Social Security number. I don't know how they, you know, how when it gets to public health, they'll know who got who's who. This is the mass ones are worse. You know, they got they come drive through. They get 10 seconds. You know, they're not picking up much detail about who that individual is. So I think we're screwed if we don't get that part fixed.
Noted. I don't think you'll get a whole lot of argument about the value of knowing who the patient is from this group. Any other comments? I will do an anecdotal comment. I mean, every one of us is going through this process and has some story to tell about their own experience. But here in Kansas, in Johnson County, I've been inundated with messages from the county health department to verify whether or not I've had my vaccine. And I don't know how I got on their list, but they found me. And so there are processes that are not perfect, but that do help deal with
this. That's encouraging.
So when I...
Okay.
Last meeting when I mentioned this topic, I think I wanted to talk about something that was slightly broader than just the reporting data flow, even though it might be potentially out of scope. But I mentioned that essentially private companies globally are now setting up these travel passports that was just mentioned, and they are essentially just making up standards on the fly. If we can somehow standardize this, this will be a tremendous advance in HIT, like globally all at once, because there's no question that these passports are going to get built for COVID.
Yeah, just clarification there, because I'm involved in some of that work. There is standard work going on. There's coordination with HL7 around a fire-based protocol for doing this. If you go to VCI, Vaccine Credential Initiative, you'll see links to the underlying standards work. There's an international, there's a WHO international cred. So there is some work to align some of the proposed standards for international creds with the proposed standards for local. And then as we'll see, this is an area that ONC is already going deep on and doing standards coordination. So I think the request for us is no further prioritization effort needed from us, because this is an area that ONC is already pushing hard on.
Well, I'd argue against that. I think this is the most important shot on the whole ship, and all the because it's time urgency. And whether we give it priority, we're not going to do it, but I think it's a very high priority, the highest, I think.
Well, and Clem, I think ONC would agree with you and say they've already prioritized it, and they have. Apparently dedicated considerable resources to actively working on it. So we don't need to surface it as a priority, because they've already done that. It's the message we've got.
Okay.
We're just telling them.
Too on, because that does
yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, we're trying to identify areas, I think in a sense, areas that have been missed or need additional attention, as opposed to areas that are already being addressed. So that was the message we got. Let's keep moving, because we've got a lot to cover. Next slide, please. Okay, health equity. I will admit that this is not a strong point for me to wrangle this space. It's complicated, and I haven't spent a lot of time thinking about it, I'm sorry to admit. But broadly speaking, there are a couple of areas that we highlighted. One was the social determinants of health data that needs to be captured. Is it being captured? Do the standards that should capture it, are they adequate? Are they being used where they should be being used? And then in the real world, are people doing it. Let's say it's well deployed, but it's just not being captured at the point of care for reasons that might include cultural issues, training issues, complexity of the user experience, and so forth. Then there's a an access access axis of this, where if you have electronic systems that are crucial for delivery of critical care, crucial care, I should say, do the people who need to know have a way to get at that information? If everything is on a smartphone and they don't have a smartphone, is that a problem? Should we have standards that address sort of minimum access capabilities such as web browsers in a library or something like that? Those are some of the issues that got raised. I see Ken, you've got your hand up.
Yeah, thanks. I do think this is a pretty important issue, right? So just a few comments or some things that may not have been thought about. I think the SDOH and race ethnicity information is kind of related, and I don't know if folks have seen the article in New England Journal last fall, basically saying, hey, we use so many algorithms in clinical care built into EHRs and such that have unintended consequences, where essentially, for example, we might say, you know, because this patient is Black, we're going to assume that, you know, these negative outcomes are going to occur, and therefore we will not provide clinical treatment to them, where we're conflating issues of the effects of racism versus, you know, biological differences. So I think that's an area where the notion of capturing social determinants of health can make a difference, right? Because if we capture things like educational attainment consistently and have them available, if we capture things like homelessness, I mean, then we are using actual factors rather than proxies, right? Like assuming that because you're a Black female who's 55 years old, that, you know, your educational level is this and et cetera. I mean, those are, that's, I think, just one thing to keep in mind where this can be really a direct addressing and doesn't get into the whole details of what we do with that information necessarily, but would be important. I think another really important issue that I started getting more aware of is the lack of digital access for vulnerable populations like the elderly and, you know, certain population groups, where I was just shocked to learn, like, hey, if you're over a certain age, like a third of those folks don't have internet access, right? And especially as we start thinking about the need for patient engagement to deal with a lot of these issues, I think that's another potential area where, you know, maybe not even thinking of what do we do when the patient doesn't have internet access, and are there, you know, standards and policies around there that can help. And I'm looking at things like, well, those folks typically have phones, but there's a lot of regulations around you may not contact patients using automated phone call based technologies. And it's just like the regulations, even though you can text them, you know, those kinds of things. And I think there's issues like that where, I mean, if you, you know, have a smartphone and can open a app, maybe that's fine. And that's an exciting area. But I think this is an area where there's a real potential to, you know, help address this. So anyway,
Ken, just a couple questions there. So I think your last point is the bottom two points that we're listing under health equity. And it's more than just disadvantaged, homeless, digital divide, you know, aged, et cetera. There was a really good study, I think it was the University of Michigan did the underlying reporting. It was reported out in Politico somewhere, and I'll see if I can dig it up. But the gist of it was that only 60% of people over, I think it was 65, had portal access. But then when you dug one level deeper, there was a huge educational attainment gap where if you looked at, you know, high school and below versus some college and above, there's a 20% gap, and that's actually the same race-based divide gap, which indicates that probably the contributing factor is educational attainment. But it was pretty sobering that if we're looking at portal-based access as our vaccine enrollment mechanism, then by definition, you know, we've got a 20% attainment gap or 20% outreach gap. I think your first topic, let me just restate what I think your first topic is, which is the general topic of, as we're using machine learning and AI to learn appropriateness of care or clinical decision support, it's very important that we not unintentionally learn pre-existing bias. Is that the point there?
That's exactly right, where we may be systematizing the impact of bias rather than anything biologic related to race.
That's a good point. And I also have a concern, just the sort of almost the irony that as we try to become race and gender blind in the sense of being blind to the biases, or let's say eliminating our biases, to force people to ask these questions and capture the data is essentially sort of a conflict. And I think there may be some cultural issues that affect how people are trained at points of care to capture some of this information that I get a sense hasn't been really thought through. Let me ask if anybody on the call, anybody in our group is aware of or participating in the HL7 Fire Gravity project, which apparently is working on profiling fire for SDOH.
Ricky's got his hand up.
I've had a little involvement.
Ricky?
Oh, sure, I want to interrupt Clem.
Yeah, Clem, if you can just raise your hand and we'll get Ricky first and then Clem will drop you in.
Yeah,
sure,
Ricky,
Thanks. I have not been involved in Gravity, but I just wanted to make a comment that on the bullet here, why is sensitive data so often not being captured? One of the things that comes up, and I think it's been touched on a little bit, is a concern about privacy and how that data could be misused and could potentially result in additional bias. Obviously, from a healthcare perspective, having that information is really, really important so we can have a complete data. One of the examples that has come up recently, and there have been some articles about it that you may be aware of, is how GFR is often reported as having, you know, two different versions, a high version and a low version. And it's been found, I think there's a New England Journal perspective on this, that the underlying data that they found that the Black population that they were using to measure actually had worse function. It wasn't a genetic thing or a ethnicity thing. It was just that population had worse function. And then that was built into downstream use cases like being eligible for a renal transplant. And they were being denied access because of this GFR value that was being reported erroneously. And so now more organizations are moving to remove that distinction. And so it's just one anecdote that shows how sometimes there are good intentions in trying to find information and distinctions there, but it can actually lead to a lot of significant unintended consequences.
Right, and that's probably secondary to systematic undertreatment of hypertension for Black Americans.
Yep.
And again, just a central point of it that Ken was noting about you know, our algorithms are learning bias as opposed to learning essential differences. Clem?
Well, there's a couple things. First, I have a little bit of connection with Gravity, and they really have worked through a pretty darn good set of questions, and they've got them standardized and everything set. And I think it's moving well, and there's a lot of support from it. The second thing is about smartphones. So it's really an age thing rather than, maybe in addition to, but mostly rather than an age than a race thing. So 96% of people in the U.S. up to age 30, I just found out on the web, have smartphones. Something like 94% up to age 50, and then it drops off fast. So old people don't have them. Maybe old Blacks have fewer of them. I don't know that, but I think we have to pay attention to the age cutoffs on these kind of things. And then there was a third thing, but I think I've lost it that I wanted to add to. Never mind. Okay.
Well, one of the things, this is David again, one of the things that I thought about when I read about the Gravity Project, and I was impressed with at least the scope of what they are trying to address, is that we might invite someone from that group to address our group if we think this is a priority item, because it may well be that much of the work that we would argue should be being done is being done, and we might just endorse it. So that's something that we'll have to consider as we plan our future meetings, is whether to invite someone to help.
Just to call out to you, something I've been thinking about as we've been having these conversations, just call out to ONC staff, but I think it's going to be really important for us to hear from people who the makeup of this particular task force is pretty heavily white and Asian. I think it's going to be really important for us to learn from and hear from people of color who are working to address some of these topics. So I think we're talking about good things. I think we're just going to need to hear more perspectives as we work our way through this area.
If I could come back to one of the questions about the lack of collecting the data. So to emphasize that, and the COVID data from CDC, over 40% had no racial data. And at my hospital, when I was in the hospital, there was a real reluctance of clerks, whether they're black or white. In fact, I think there was more often they were black, to ask a person that data because it made them feel like they were being racist.
That was my point about the cultural issues here, is that we can have all the standards in the world and good implementations and people just don't want to capture it. But I get offended when people ask me those questions. In surveys and things like that. I mean, why do you need to know what I am? I think in EU, it's illegal, right? I mean, you can't even ask it. So, okay, let's move on. Next slide. Hang on a second. Is that out of order? No, that's right. Okay. I'm looking at my notes wrong. Okay, better usage of EHR data. Broad thought here is there's digital data on the table that is not necessarily being utilized, particularly in urgent situations where you need access to that data. For example, in hypothesis generation at the beginning of the pandemic, I was watching back in March on Twitter and people were fretting that we didn't know what drugs to try and whether people were trying drugs and nobody knew whether they worked or not. And there was a thought that there was a lot of EHR data that could have helped with those questions. And I think over the course of 2020, some of that data started to flow. Vendors started doing vendor-specific amongst their clients, aggregation, de-identification, and serving up the data. But it took a long time. And it occurred to me that maybe with the bulk APIs that are now coming into required implementation for EHRs, and with this the stabilizing around things like OMOP and OHSDI, not that that's the only choice, maybe we could do a better job of responding urgently to aggregation of data for purposes of helping understand what's happening in a pandemic. That's as opposed to clinical trial use of the data and real-world evidence use of the data, which are also on this slide as broadly part of the notion of better capitalizing on existing EHR data. This one strikes me as something that is in the purview of ONC and could be a really useful area. Personal preference there. But what do others think? Any ideas? Any hands up?
Clem's got his hand up.
Clem? We're not hearing you, Clem. You may be muted.
Why we're not focusing more on the health information exchanges, which have already aggregated data. And one of the problems with data that's not pre-processed is it's often crummy. I mean, it helps, you know, when they run it in and run through some filters before they put it together. When you grab it at once, there's often that need is overlooked. But in any case, we just seem to ignore the health information exchanges as a source of aggregated data, which is often organized in an easier way than going to 10 different hospitals who may be sending it to those health information exchanges.
Okay, good point. Not to debate it at the moment. We'll come back to it if it gets our fire to march. Any other comments on this one?
Yeah, I just think we should look at Aaron. the UK recovery experience. I think most of the data that we have, for example, on dexamethasone use, anticoagulant therapy, the rule-out trials for hydroxychloroquine and ivermectin, were all done in the UK in the recovery trial framework. And, you know, I think we've got equivalent electronic health infrastructure in the U.S., but we don't have the mechanism for doing that level of, call it comparative effectiveness research. So I think we should just look at what was it in the UK that made the recovery trial framework effective that's a missing element in the US?
Good idea.
Yeah, great idea. Okay, given that we're got a lot to cover still, let's go to the next slide. Gaps in adverse event reporting. Arian, I think you may have been the one that brought this one up. You want to explain what the opportunities here might be?
Yeah, so FDA has set up a set of electronic adverse event reporting structures. FDA requires adverse event reporting. There's a VAERS form for vaccines. There's equivalent forms for drugs, biologics, and medical devices. There's a singular reporting structure now that FDA has. That reporting structure requires accessing a portal and typing information into a portal. So it doesn't have the ability to extract information out of an EHR and send it to FDA. And then when there is actually an electronic safety reporting system, but it uses clinical trials terminology like MEDRA as opposed to clinical terminology like SNOMED and ICD-10 for the underlying terminology. So, you know, the ideal state here would be, this is a standards gap state. The ideal state here is that there's an easy to use safety reporting mechanism that works across drugs, biologics, vaccines, and medical devices. And allows for easy generation of adverse events out of EHRs for signal detection into FDA that isn't tied into the FDA clinical trial standards. And, you know, that might also require FDA to, I know this is sort of shocking if you're FDA, but might require FDA to map MEDRA over to SNOMED. And for all I know, ILM may already have done this.
Any comments on this broad topic? If not, let's move to the next slide, please. Contact and exposure tracking. I think the self-evident topic, there were some early gaps. Early in the pandemic of 2020, the Duke Margolis work group put out some recommendations about gaps in outbound lab data that was missing demographic data that made contact tracing more difficult. So that's one point. Another one is there have been a number of experiments, probably a dozen, of using smartphones to track exposure based on proximity with Bluetooth and or other proximity detection measures, GPS, et cetera. Maybe there's something that's emerging from the learning in that space that we could focus on. And it occurred to me, just my personal, I put this one on the list, is that the NBA and the NFL were reasonably successful in their bubble management. And is there anything to learn from that? Did they do something? Did they figure out something that we could leverage from? Comments on this one? Clem, your hand.
One other thing to add, Clem's in the list. One other thing to add here is, as we get a rapid testing approach, is how do we make sure that we have we have case reporting tied into rapid testing. Clem?
You're muted, Clem.
Extreme resistance to conceiving that the virus could be transmitted by air, you know, in aerosol, and which I think is finally relaxed. But nobody has studied the ventilation systems in nursing homes, the ventilation systems on ships, which are known to have poor filters. Nobody's filtering the air in big places to figure out where the risk is and the details about it. It's all been the physicists who've actually even highlighted the area by doing the flow of the little droplets around. So I think that's almost sinful that we've missed that point. But I don't know whether that's an informatics thing. It probably isn't. But.
Yeah. I know they did some amazing experiments in Germany. I think I was reading about a massive study with ventilation in a theater with careful tracking of how the exposure was affected by outside air versus inside air, where you sat in the theater, how close you sat. It was a remarkable, massive study.
Yeah,
no, so it's been addressed by some people, but
I've seen some of those, but they haven't actually measured sampling. There's air sampler devices with viruses, although there's you got to be careful of having one that's sensitive enough. Anyway,
yeah.
I think we really screwed
okay.
up on that one.
Ricky, are you still on? I was going to ask, do you feel that the Apple Google smartphone exposure tracking is worth our attention? I don't mean to put you on the spot. You may not feel like you're allowed to respond.
Sure. Happy to share a little bit. I think there have been a lot of conversations on this topic, mostly with public health authorities, and given that this needs to be driven by them and their implementation, it's also been implemented around the world, and perhaps there's something we can learn. I just put a link in here to the UK government. They've done a lot of research on this topic to know how effective it has been, and based on their analytics, they predict that 600,000 cases have been prevented. Obviously, there are differences between how things work in the U.S. and how things work in other countries that we need to be mindful of. To your question as to whether this should be a area of focus, it seems to me that there are a number of conversations with the CDC and others in the U.S. on how to do this, and I'm not sure if there's an explicit role of the ONC to do more here or to offer standards, since that's our charge, beyond what's already there, but certainly worth at least considering here. And if there's something specific that someone can think about that might be worth exploring, we should definitely discuss it.
Thanks. Okay, let's go to the next one. Next slide, please. Care plans and the burden of chronic disease. This is, as I mentioned, sort of an unfinished area from our 2019 discussion. Does anyone, I think, Arian, maybe you were the one who raised this in our first meeting's discussion. And I know, Ken, obviously, you were very involved in driving the 2019 conversation. Do either of you want to say anything about this one?
Sure, I can comment. I mean, I think related to this also is the notion of, how can we provide higher value, lower cost care? I think it's sort of related to that. But the challenging part is it's a very big topic, right? And it's very hard when it's a big topic on how we're going to address these things. One way to potentially narrow this down is to say, what are specific data elements needed for things that we specifically are trying to address? So one example might be a new lung cancer screening guideline just came out like last week, right? And as it turns out, FHIR doesn't include a few key data elements in there. And the current USCDI process, the way I'm reading it, it might take another 5 or 10 years to move it forward. So, looking at it from that perspective, and as we think about what are the things we probably should do that we're not doing, one of them might be, a process that's going to take 10 years to address, screening and preventing the number one cause of cancer deaths in this country. So that might be one way to sort of narrow it down to say, if we're trying to address these kinds of issues, where are the gaps and what's going to happen if we leave it to status quo? So anyway, so that's out there.
Yep, and then I would just add to that, Ken, thank you. I would just add to that that the basic notion is sort of in the should category, which is that patients, providers, nurse care managers should access a shared plan of care that is prioritized and rank ordered and salient for the patient. I think there are some standards in this place for plan of care. It might be worthwhile just looking at, is this an area where there are early success stories that we can lean on? Is this a standards gap or a clinical practice gap issue? And I think this will get into this when we think about the the prioritization framework. I mean, I think if we think about our own lives, we would note that plan of care is often sort of happen in the conversation with the physician or the nurse, their scribbled notes, their discharge, their scribbled out discharge documents. And so there seems to be a gap here, you know, maybe some network stickiness in terms of addressing the gap.
Clem, my two bits on this one.
Okay, Clem,
go ahead,
check your mute button first before you start before you start talking.
Yeah.
I worry a little bit about us focusing on more documentation rather than more health. And I think that Ken's idea is good. We should focus down on actual things that we could gather as part of documentation that would actually be actionable and useful. I mean, physicians are already, you know, hating computers because of the amount of documentation they have to do, and they don't really feel it's doing a lot of help, good for health. So that's my only concern. If we focus down and pick the things that can have an effect or know have an effect, those are the things we should do.
Yeah, Clem, that was what I was going to say as well. I've been in a conversation outside this group with a couple of folks who are working on the FHIR care plan refinement, and I've looked at some of their early work, and it's beautifully elaborate and detailed and logical, but the burden of capturing all that information in the process of giving care strikes me as overwhelming. So I have serious fear that we could have a beautiful theoretical model for what a plan of care should look like, but no one would ever touch it because it's too it doesn't degrade gracefully into the real world of actual decision making.
I think that
might be a topic.
I think it's the prioritization framework, David, because I think this is conflated the prioritization framework of, you know, how do we think about jobs that want to get done but aren't currently done by the health system, or getting done by the healthcare system, or getting done in a way that is patient unfriendly, but getting it done more friendly actually adds documentation burden. So we can talk about that in the context of the prioritization framework.
Okay, so let's move to the next one. Better and easier binding between persons and their digital devices. I think this was Les Leonard's topic, and I don't see him on the call today. I didn't gather in my notes a lot of information.
Sort of editorialize. I think there's two things here. One is medical devices. So how do we better tie medical devices into the interoperability notions that we have, and the sort of the basic notion that I think the HIT Standards Committee called for UDI to be included in USCDI, and there's been a long-running call for UDI to be included in claims. As far as I know, neither of those two things have been done and universally collected. And then I think Les's point was, or whoever raised this topic, was how do we better tie patient identity into the digital devices that they currently carry, and can we use those digital devices as tokens for identity and authentication and authorization? Ricky might have something to say about this topic, there's a pretty obvious point that the device that people carry around is in many cases one of the best tokens that we have for who they are and what they and what they've authorized. I don't know, Ricky, if you want to comment.
I don't have too much to say. I agree with what you just said. I think the key here would be to do this in an open standards-based way, of course. And so you'd need alignment across the ecosystem and defining the specific use case, exactly what you want to achieve with it, and then which standards could be used or could be created for that purpose.
It strikes me that maybe some of the work that's being done on the vaccination passport and that uses some of the W3C sovereign identity management or personal identity management standards might have some relevance here, but it's beyond my knowledge level. Maybe there's some spin out from that work.
Let's do a time check. How are we doing on time?
We're top of the hour, so we have 30 minutes. And we only have...
I think we have 20 minutes because we've got to get open time for public comment.
Right. We only got two more topics here, so let's buzz through them. Next slide. Integration of clinical and administrative data. I'll just reference that there are several efforts underway outside of the sort of strict EHR clinical use of FHIR to profile administrative data, electronic prior authorization, the Da Vinci work, some of the groups that are trying to leverage fast FHIR for, or I'd say bulk FHIR, I think is a better way to describe that, for aggregating data for other purposes besides direct patient care. So this is just a broad placeholder. Any suggestion, Ariel?
Yeah, I'd also reference ICAD. Yeah, the ICAD task force recommendations in the space, David, where the ICAD task
force. Which one?
ICAD.
I don't know that.
Yeah, it's the intersection of clinical and administrative data with a task force spun up and submitted recommendations to ONC. So there's a pretty good baseline of recommendations that we could look at. Clem has his hand up.
Clem?
I just want to know how it's coming. You know, I these are areas that are very active now, but I've not been able to keep connected. If somebody somewhere online could give us sort of a summary of how it's moving, is it happy, and is it getting there?
Yeah, so maybe I'll give a status here, which is that the Da Vinci EPA recommendations were called into CMS regulation for, I believe, QHPs, but not MA plans, if my memory serves correctly. I wasn't sure why that distinction was made. There are the ICAD task force made a broader call that looks at EPA as the first use case, but notes that the intersection of clinically adjudicated claims or clinically adjudicated authorization, use of attachments and the like is becoming more prevalent, that there's no attachment standards named by CMS. And broadly, just based on the slow progress of administrative standards relative to clinical standards, even though the rest of us are tearing our hair out at the slow pace of clinical standards, the recommendation was for ONC to align the standards evolution framework and to set a roadmap for aligning clinical administrative standards. And, you know, the natural implication of that is we probably should align all of our standards around FHIR, but also just make sure that we've got harmonization of clinical models and administrative models to make sure that we're asking for consistent data and data sets and can represent them in a consistent way. So, you know, that there isn't such a divide between administrative standards and clinical standards. So the summary, Clem, to your request is the EPA recommendations that were made by Da Vinci are enshrined in regulation at this point, and then there's a broader call for broader alignment between administrative and clinical transactions. And this was even though the ICAD task force was a task force of sort of subtask force under the HITAC, about half the membership was NCVHS as well, which is the FHCA that makes recommendations on administrative standards to CMS. So there's also potentially another recommendation that we start to align the work of NCVHS and the HITAC.
Thank you, Arian. That's very helpful.
Yeah. Next slide. I think this is our last one. Better data sharing between the systems that are inside the military standard security layer, VA and DoD, and outside.
Maybe I'll make some editorial comments
here
to frame it, and then we can decide in our prioritization framework whether to pick it up. But this is a recurring need, and it shows up in some of the TEPCA work. It shows up in some of the work that VA and DoD, as they're adopting a new EHR and thinking about joining national networks, is wrestling with. I've come across this work in in administrative networks as well. And the systematic issue is that VA and DoD are held by FISMA and NIST RMS standards to a certain security posture for VA and DoD owned data. There's security classifications, for example, in the DoD, health data is considered critical readiness data. So, you know, if you've got, as an example, if you've got COVID infecting a large number of service members, that could be a sign in military readiness. And so that data is classified at a fairly high level of sensitivity. And that's all great when you're inside the DoD boundary or inside the VHA boundary. But when you start thinking about, as an example, VA trying to interoperate data on the veteran's behalf with health systems using national networks, you think about DoD doing the same thing for service members that are cared for by TRICARE and are receiving care in the community. You know, most VA vets primarily receive care in the community, have primary insurance that is commercial insurance, and then use VHA benefits as secondary insurance for certain conditions, and often, you know, for example, doing med renewals through the VHA. And so when you think about trying to apply the DoD and VA security boundaries and the FedRAMP requirements for cloud-based services, you start thinking about where is the service boundary between VA and DoD, and where's the commercial end? And, you know, one level of absurdity says that we just apply all of the VA and DoD security controls and mandate FedRAMP CUI for everybody. That's the minimum security standard for everybody. And, you know, if you do that, you're probably raising the security bar for the U.S. healthcare system. But you're effectively running all of the U.S. healthcare system on a federal standard as opposed to addressing the federal commercial standard mismatch. We saw this also in direct with the level of assurance that was required for signing certificates and authentication certificates. It's been a persistent issue of how does the VA and DoD interchange data with the rest of the U.S. healthcare sector.
Okay, any comments on that broad topic other than Arian's thorough review?
Clem has his hand up.
But not his mic.
Clem, go ahead. Open mic.
It's a regulatory thing rather than a technical thing, and it's been killing them. It's been killing us in a lot of spaces where we're not cohesive in that area. So in Indianapolis, all the hospitals participate in one IHE. VA couldn't. I think I heard rumors that they can now. I don't know if that could be true. But there's all these things, and they're so privacy conscious, excessively beyond any reasonable use, and much of it might come from these regulatory legislative things that I don't know about. But they got to deal with those things.
Yep, agreed.
Yep. That's why it got on our list. Okay, I think that's the scope of our existing domains. The last domain is the vaccination passports, which we've said we are not going to dive into any deeper since ONC is already running with that one, has groups already running with that one. So, Arian, I think our plan is to shift over and talk about how we might think through the prioritization of these domains and anything else that we add in. So the show is yours.
All right. So we're just going to walk through some proposed prioritization and recommendation frameworks, looking for feedback from this group about whether the approach for prioritization makes sense and the approach for recommendations makes sense. We're going to do a hard stop at 12:25 to open up for public comments. Let's go to the first slide. All right. So first proposed framework for prioritization. So we're just going to assume that just given the list we walked through, we're going to have more that wants to get done than is going to get done. And so we need to put a framework in place for prioritization. And so the proposed framework here is let's prioritize areas that align with ONC declared priority areas. So that's COVID-19, health equity, 21st century cures enablement, and unmet needs on the existing ONC roadmap. Let's avoid areas already being covered through existing ONC initiatives. And so our commentary on the vaccine passport initiative sort of falls in this area. And then once we've thought about our priority areas, let's prefer foundational and or leveraged areas. So, you know, where's a solution that is more, that unlocks other solutions as opposed to, you know, a solution that's, what's at the trunk versus what's at the leaf in my computer science graph theory way of thinking about it. Similar prioritization framework. Let's prioritize areas that have general solution areas or general solution domains over something that is specific and solves just one thing. Obviously, that if that gets trumped by overall prioritization, so be it. But in the context that we have a choice, let's prefer things that have general applicability as opposed to specific applicability. Existence of well-defined policy levers over novel policy levers required. So, you know, it's nice to want to advance an area, but, you know, if it requires, and we'll see this in the next slide in terms of how we think about the recommendation, but if it requires completely new policy levers to go get done, that might be a reason to shy away, might not. And then, as we were discussing in the plan of care conversation, you know, we should prefer areas where the jobs are already being done but inefficiently, over areas where we want the health system to do better. And again, that's a little bit of a double-edged sword, but we're likely to have more traction where something's being done already, but it's being done in a dumb and inefficient way. Then we are going to get traction in a case where we want something to get done, but it's just not getting done right now. So I'm going to pause and see if these prioritization framework concepts make sense, and if there's prioritization items that we're missing as we think about how we prioritize these items. So, you know, just in general to repeat, it's let's look for need first, lined up against ONC objectives, striking out anything that ONC is already addressing. Let's look at generality and leverage second, and then down in kind of a third tier priority, let's think about areas where there's express need already as opposed to, you know, need that wants to happen in areas where there's already some policy guide rails or ground rails. Any comments? If you have to noodle on this because it's the first time you've seen it, this is not your last track at it, or not your last crack at it, but please do noodle on it and think about whether this is an appropriate mechanism for prioritization. Seeing no hands up, let us go.
I think it's good, Arian.
Yeah.
I like it.
Seeing no hands up, let's go to the next one, which is how do we think about recommendations? And so this came out of some conversation with ONC about, you know, some of the feedback from the last ISP task force. It's useful to chunk recommendations into timeframes. So in some cases, there's work that can be done immediately. Other cases, there's some timeframe implications that may be medium term or long term. And this is useful to set expectation for ONC that, you know, we didn't deliver 50,000 recommendations and there's a sort of pregnant assumption that they all need to get done right now. In many cases, we have prioritizations that are easy wins and, you know, other areas that are going to require some more foundational work, and it's useful to call out the foundational work. And then we also want to consider the type of action required, and so just from easiest to hardest, there's areas where there's industry alignment and voluntary action around existing standards. So as an example, when we looked at this in the Duke-Margolis Task Force on COVID, we saw that the standards for ELR and the standards for lab orders was already there, and, you know, there was better alignment needed around what data is required to collect, and in many cases that just required people to stand up and raise their hand and say, yeah, I'm going to go actually wire the wires that aren't yet wired together, because I think a lot of the finding was that this data was in EHRs, but it wasn't flowing over to labs, and from labs wasn't flowing over to public health, and so this may just be an area of wiring up things around existing standards. Second is, okay, we have a standards gap, but there's clear alignment that we need to address. Sorry, we have standards, but we have a gap relative to adoption of the standard, but there's clear alignment that we just need to go do, put in the hard work. Everyone agrees we just need to go put in the hard work, and so we just go do it. Second is, we don't have the standard, or the standard isn't yet where it's ready, and so therefore there's some standards work that's required. And this is an area where ONC aligns with industry and with SDOs, following the playbook that, you know, ONC's gotten very good at, which is to define priority, get the SDOs in place, get industry in place, and go work through some of the nitty-gritty standards work to make sure that we have standards readiness. And then the third set of actions are harder. In my experience, they are sets of actions that end up being more leveraged. So it's unfortunate that the hard thing also is the more leveraged thing. But we discover a lot of times we have all the standards we need, they're just not all getting used. And so that's an incentive alignment problem. And again, going striking from easiest to hardest, that might be that we need to line up ONC certification requirements with other HHS rulemaking requirements. So the classic one there is making sure that we get CMS levers for adoption along with ONC levers for adoption. Slightly harder is incorporating CLIA and FDA, IHS, other areas where there are, other non-HHS actors like FEP or DOD and VHA. So that's an example where the federal government just needs to line up incentives to point in a consistent direction. That's easy. The second area are areas where there's literal acts of Congress that are required. So as an example here, Patty Murray, as part of the HELP committee, has proposed a bill for creating consistent funding for public health, and then tying that funding to standards. We may or may not want to endorse that overall approach, but that's an approach that requires, literal acts of Congress and appropriation. And then down at the hardest level is, cases where the classic area here is HIPAA alignment or health privacy alignment, where, if only states generally did more or less the same things, we'd actually get more interoperability, and that's been a time immemorial issue that we've been working on, and we keep saying the same thing, and so it's just one of these areas that's hard, but still needful if we believe that multi-state alignment is required. So again, just to repeat the prioritization framework on the top, for recommendations rather, on the top, let's consider the time frame for recommendations, and also let's consider the type of policy alignment or the type of work that's required to advance the ball, whether this is, hey, we got the standards and we need to use them, and there's actually alignment that we need to use them. So this is more of a project management, national coordinator, bully pulpit role. Second is we actually need to develop some standards and test them and put them through the standards priorities, standards evolution, whatever we call the standards evolution framework, which we've now got a good one on ONC. And the third one is where we require more incentives and more incentive alignment, and that requires some hard regulatory work. So I'm going to pause there and see if this makes sense as a proposed framework for recommendations. Please raise your hand. And again, also feel free to noodle if this is throwing a lot at you and you need to think about it and add something, you'll get another crack at it.
Arian, when is your textbook on How Does Government Work coming out?
I've also been calling for Steve Posnack to do his recurring podcast on take a grotty bit of regulation that you think has no business being there and trace it up the stack to what Congress asked for. And How does the APA work? And there's just so much nitty gritty that's involved in getting this stuff done. It's fun stuff, but it's also mind boggling.
Well, what I think our challenge might be, a little bit of offline challenge for Arian and I and the ONC team, and then come back to the group for refinement, would be how to collapse these sort of, I would say, profound and deep thoughts into something that could be put into columns of a spreadsheet where we have checkboxes and, you know, ways to capture at a high level, you know, how to score some of these ideas and then apply, you know, some kind of a scoring algorithm that that we could generate a rank. So,
agreed. And I think we've also heard, and I think, David, you alluded to this in the beginning, that there are some cases where even though something is hard, it is worth saying we recommend that ONC, and again, let's look at the Medra case. We recommend that ONC work with FDA to create a standard for safety reporting that aligns with clinical standards and not just clinical trial standards. It's useful for other federal agencies to hear that a FACA lined up and said, yeah, this is important, go do it. Because there's always, you know, if you think about ONC and their long list of things that want to get done, FDA and CMS and IHS and FEP and DOD and DHA all have their long list of things that need to get done, and it's useful to hear that at least some congressionally mandated federal advisory committee said, yeah, this is important and go get it. We should open up for public comment.
Mike, are you going to?
I'm just getting myself off mute. Thank you. Operator, can you please open up the public comment line?
Yes. If you would like to make a comment, please press star 1 on your telephone keypad. A confirmation tone will indicate your line is in the queue. You may press star 2 if you would like to remove your line from the queue. And for participants using speaker equipment, it may be necessary to pick up your handset before pressing the star keys. One moment while we pull for comments.
Great. And while we're waiting, I just wanted to note our next call will be this time next Thursday from March 25th from 2 to 3:30 Eastern Time. And we sure appreciate you joining us today. Operator, are there any public comments?
There are no comments at this time.
Okay, thank you.
All right. Well, we definitely welcome public comments, and the future of standards evolution is worthy of public comment. But hearing no public comment, I think it's probably worthwhile getting ready 5 minutes to prepare for their next meeting.
One question, Arian, and maybe to Mike, to you and the ONC team. We were going to spend a little time soliciting for additional ideas. Obviously, we ran out of time, not surprisingly, given how much we had to cover. But would it be appropriate if members want to send us emails with suggestions to queue up for the next meeting that they could do so? Is that an allowable approach?
Yes, sure. That's no problem.
Okay. So hopefully the remaining members heard that. If there was something that we elided over, or something we just completely missed that occurred to you in the discussion today or between the two meetings, just put a little brief description and send it in an email to Arian and I, and we'll make sure it gets on the agenda for a future conversation.
Yep, and we'll make sure that anything that comes in that through that channel gets exposed through the public forum.
Yep.
All right.
Very good.
Thanks, everybody.
Thanks for hanging in there. Goodbye.
Bye-bye.
Thank you, guys. Good running of a meeting.
Thank you.